Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, meet a man whose Purple Heart reminds him each day how fortunate he is to be alive.
You don't remember anything about an explosion. You get a big red flash, your ears start ringing. You don't really feel any pain. You don't really know what happened either.
He knows now, and he'll tell us his whole World War II story on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you listen to us on the AM side at 1 o'clock, maybe on the FM from 5 to 6, or you listen anytime at kmjnow.com. You know that each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea is to let them know how much we appreciate what they did, to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to keep their stories alive so we can keep hearing them throughout the generations, and so us younger folks can learn a thing or two about what life was like back then and what it means to really love your country. We're going to learn some of those lessons today with 87-year-old Jim Gerhart of Sacramento, California. Let's go back a few years, like more than 70 of them. December 7th, 1941. Where were you and how'd you find out what happened at Pearl Harbor?
I was on the bank of Sacramento River doing fishing, catfishing.
Did you catch anything?
Of course, I always catch things. I only caught a couple dozen that day, though.
A couple dozen. Oh, what was the limit?
As many as you could catch. I'd caught as many as 100.
So it started out as a pretty good day for you, but how did you find out about the attack at Pearl Harbor?
When I got home, my mother told me about it. She'd heard it on the radio.
And as a young man of 17 at that time, did it mean much to you? Did it hit you that this could impact your life personally?
No, not really, except that I'd always planned going into service anyway. So it really didn't change my mind much because all it did was give me a reason to get in now that we didn't have before is all. I did watch that one particular day on the 7th, I watched a P-38 practice maneuvers over the river.
Had you ever seen a P-38 before?
No.
Different looking thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is that.
And you said you'd always wanted to get into the service. Why was that? Was there a family history? Was there something about the military that intrigued you?
I suppose. I had an uncle on my mother's side, my brother's brother. He was a minesweeper during World War I, and he was the only family member actually in service. My father was in Army, but he spent all his time in the stateside. He was in the theater business at that time. So he spent all his time in the theater down in Corcoran, California.
You said you'd always wanted to be in the service, and you decided that submarines sounded like a nice adventure for you?
Well, they sounded like the more exciting thing than being on a ship.
You'd been reading Jules Verne, hadn't you?
Well, that and the fact that I also took a couple of Navy magazines. That one was called Our Navy. And by the time I was ready to go into the service or anything like this, I knew much about the Navy and their traditions and their everything else. I could name you at that time all the sails on a vessel, all its lines, all its rigging, the whole damn thing.
So the Navy seemed like a match made in heaven for you. But as I've learned through all these conversations with veterans, God always has other plans, and a lot of times Uncle Sam had other plans, too. What derailed your ambition of being in the submarine service?
When I went down and took a physical, I mean, everything was fine until I checked my eyes. I was 5% colorblind in one eye, and that slam dunked me right there.
Was that disappointing for you?
Very disappointing.
But I guess you didn't have too much time to sulk because they probably had something else they wanted you to do, right?
Well, not really. They asked me if I wanted anything else since I had volunteered to be drafted anyway. I told him, yeah, I'd like to go into Armored Corps. And he says, well, that's possible. We can send you to Armored Corps in Kentucky then. I says, fine, we'll go that way then.
Straight to Fort Knox?
Well, they sent me to Fort Ord first for my shots and basic whatever knowledge I had to have. And I learned how to clean out stables there and take care of a kitchen.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah, I suppose it was.
Well, I guess when you have to do that kind of duty, it's exciting when you get to go somewhere else and do something else.
For me, it was. I had never been anywhere except down to the city or San Francisco, as they call it now. That's the only place I'd ever been besides up and down the valley, maybe.
Well, and you had no idea how much you'd be in for. You'd see a good chunk of the world, and you'd be wounded in the process. We're going to get some of those stories about your adventures on the ground, in the air, and all over the place. But one of the early things that you did that a lot of people don't even know about was at the time a top secret weapon they were trying to develop because of the desert war going on in North Africa. What did the tanks that you were working on, that you were training with, what did they have that your average tank did not have?
It was from the old M4 tank called General Grant, and it was refigured. They pulled a 37-millimeter cannon and turret off the top of it and rebuilt it with another turret on top of just a round can type with a slot in the side of it, at an entrance to the top, a half entrance. And inside that was a carbon light that was meant to be like a searchlight. They went out through an aperture in the front, a 2-inch by 4-inch, 24-inch aperture, and it spread a light almost 2 miles across and out. And it was supposed to be, at the time, to blind the enemy so that the enemy could not see the infantry advancing between the tanks. And the tanks would be in a column, side by side, going across the desert.
And the tanks and the guys on the tanks would be able to see all the enemy because the light was pointed at them.
Yes.
So you actually got to train with these and experience these lights in action in the Mojave or where?
Oh, yes. I experienced it. I worked them. I was part of the infantry in between them. I tested them. I repaired them, rebuilt them, whatever.
What was that like? I mean, this sounds a little exciting because it's not something many people knew about. Did you feel like you were part of something on the cutting edge and pretty special?
I guess. The most problem was that being in a secret outfit, if you went to an outfit, we were surrounded by guards. We were surrounded by fence, barbed wire fences and a 10-foot fence all the way around the valley. If you went on a pass, you had 5 men go on a pass by yourself. You had to be all five buddy system. They finally cut it down to 2 because you had to have somebody with you that could report you if you said the wrong thing to anybody. And we also had FBI embedded in the unit, too. I just happened to know who the FBI agent was in our unit, but the other people didn't know who it was.
And you can joke about it now, but at the time, was there some pressure, some anxiety that came along with that? And were you watching every word that you wrote in a letter back home? I mean, it sounds like some pretty heavy responsibility was on your shoulders.
We didn't really have to watch anything we wrote. Everything was censored anyway. And our address was an APO out of Los Angeles, so everybody thought we was overseas anyway. And the only ones that knew any different were, there was a few families that lived in the area that some of the guys went to visit on their passes. Those were the only ones that knew. And they were sworn to secrecy, too, but us being there. When you went into the camp, you were blindfolded, and you rode in the back of a truck, and the truck was closed up, too. So you didn't know where you were going from the railhead out into the desert. And you rode for 2 hours and got out of the truck, and you're in the middle of camp.
And that sounds pretty bizarre, but it sounds like you got used to it pretty quickly.
Oh, I enjoyed it all right out there. It was warm anyway.
In terms of seeing that light in action, how can you describe that for us? I'm hoping you never had to stare into it, but what kind of results did you see, at least in the training?
Well, I've seen a lot of people get organized, knew what they were doing. They learned how to line their tanks up. They learned how to steer their lights to where it's supposed to be, and how to open and close the apertures when they needed to be open and closed in sequence, the whole thing.
So the United States had this game-changing, cutting-edge weapon, and of course it was deployed with great success, and everyone lived happily ever after, right?
Well, it wasn't really deployed because the Desert War was over in Africa, and so we were sent to England. Now, this particular light was called a canal light, original name, and it was developed by the English. But they thought it would be a great thing to use out in the desert. Unfortunately, in France, they had hedgerows, and if you used it there, when you went over a hedgerow, the light was pointed at the sky. And when you came down, it was pointed at the ground. And so it wasn't much use in France.
So most of that training and all this secrecy really went to waste. The Americans were never really able to use it in World War II.
We did use it once on the Rhine. We crossed one bridge, and they used it for crossing the bridge. They were successful in blinding the enemy enough to be able to get troops across the bridge and on pontoon bridges across the river.
And when were you sent overseas? This is with the 736th Medium Tank Battalion?
Yeah, Medium Tank Battalion Special.
And the special means?
Because we had the tanks. And we also had tanks that also were made into what they call ducks. And they had a canvas cover that went around them and had propellers on them that could be used as boats. And they worked pretty successful.
So when did you ship out, and what was that like for you? Were you nervous? Were you anxious? Were you looking forward to it?
Well, I was kind of looking forward to it. We shipped out by train out of Yuma I don't remember much about the trip. I was a guard on one of the cars. And the only thing that was outstanding about the trip, we stopped in Schenectady, I think it was, New York.
Schenectady, yeah, near Albany.
Yeah, my car happened to stop right at the station. And every time you stopped, you got out with your gun and your machine gun and stood out there, guard the train. And I had a civilian come up and look at my gun. He says, "You know, we got one of them right downtown in a display window in the store." He says, "That's a German machine gun, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, it's a German machine gun." What it was what we call a grease gun. It was the newest machine gun at that time that was in existence for the American Army. 45 caliber, automatic, 20-round feed. It was a good gun.
And you describe that as if you know a thing or two about ammunition and weapons from World War II. And I'm going to put a picture or two online at kmjnow.com, and people will understand why you know so much about that. But let's get on to your story. So you're going to head out of New York Harbor or what?
Out of New York Harbor on the Queen Elizabeth I. We was A deck. We had our own cabin, of course. Had 12 bunks in the cabin. And I was the only one that didn't get seasick. And since I was always hungry, I had to figure out a way to get food. The English didn't believe in feeding you. Their meals consisted of coffee in the morning, which would taste like strong tea, toast and marmalade, and mutton that was sliced thin to make it look like bacon. That was your breakfast, and the rest of the meals were just about the same. And you only got three of these a day, so I had to find a job that gave me more food. So I found a job at cleaning up passageways, which gave me a pass on all three sections of the ship. There were red, white, and blue sections, and you weren't allowed to go from one section to another. So I had access to the whole ship, which gave me a chance to see the whole ship from the engine room to the boat deck. I investigated the whole ship, and of course I ate meals in every one of the sections too.
Well, and the way you describe this, it sounds like just a great big adventure for you. Did it ever occur to you that you could get hurt or killed in the line of work you're going
to
be doing?
Oh, it occurred to me, but when I left the States, I was engaged to a girl, and she'd broke it off not about a month or two after I got into service, and she took off and got married anyway. At the time, the only reason I didn't get married before that, because there was always a 50-50 chance I'd either come be killed or come home crippled. So 50-50 chances, pretty good odds, of course, but I didn't want to put that on anybody, so that's the reason I... The only thing that bothered me was that part.
Well, understandably so. So you get across the Atlantic. Now, this is something that about your story that I think is pretty unique, because I've had plenty of guys from every branch of service, but you kind of dabbled in a whole bunch of different ones. You wanted to get into the Navy. You end up in the Armored Corps in this medium tank battalion. But before D-Day, you were up in a B-17 on a reconnaissance mission. How in the world did that happen?
Well, my commanding officer, Captain Glenn O. Rogers, he was a graduate of Brown University out of Texas, and he was quite a man. I was a so-called volunteer, and being a volunteer, or spare parts, as we called them, you had the job of taking the place of anybody that could not do their job, or were absent, or could not find any, which included any place that they called us to replace anybody. In this particular time, we're speaking of on the recon mission, was they needed a radio man, which I had specialized in training, and they sent me to London to the air base there. I guess it was 8th Air Force.
So in all your tank training, the specialty you had developed was radio communication. You were a radio man with the tank battalion.
Well, partially. At times I was, and other times I was driver. Every time I was test driver, mechanic, or whatever.
Jack of all trades, or Jim of all trades, as the case may be. So they need a radio man for this B-17 mission.
So I get to the airport, or the aerodrome, as they call them there, and I report to the CO there, and he takes me out and introduces me to the line chief. And he takes me over to the airplane and introduces me to the crew chief. And so he takes me aboard, and he shows me where my radio is. And, of course, all the rest of the guys get on the plane, and they're warming up the engine and all this bit. And they dress me in my clothes and my... Show me where my parachute is and all this. So then he says, "Oh yeah, the other position, your second position is there." And he points down below and into the bulk turret on the billy gun. And I told him, "I want no part of this thing, let me out of here." And he says, "Well, if you can walk in there, you're too willing to it." I looked out the port, we were 500 feet off the ground already. So when we got over the channels, he told me to test out the guns, and I got over the channels, so I tested out the 50s. And they all worked fine, we flew off.
And this is spring of 1944, would you say March or April or when?
It was probably about April.
So D-Day is still a couple months away.
But they, had, of course, had been trying to make the Germans believe we were going into another place in Calais, which was the closest point on the channel. And they had actually deployed a complete battalion of tanks made out of balloons.
Yeah, the rubber tanks, the fake rubber tanks, yep.
And General Patton, in fact, was in charge of them. So, anyhow, we go on this trip, and it was nice looking at the countryside until we got into some flak from the German aircraft. And we didn't get any fights, air fights with them, but one of the pieces of flak hit my ring over my head on my turret, and the turret was stuck, and I couldn't get out, and they couldn't pick me up. So we had to land with the turret down, which is, well, to put it mildly, kind of scary, because if a tire blows out, you're dead. You're only 4 inches off the tarmac.
Now, and the purpose of this mission was to snap some photos to see where the German forces were aligned to prepare for the invasion?
I assume this is what it was for, yeah. They didn't tell me as much, but I assume this is what it was for.
But your duties were to handle radio communication and also, if that belly gun needed to be fired at the fighters coming after this bomber, then you were to do that.
I never did use the radio. I only used the turret gun. That's all I ever did.
And then because of the opposing fire that hit that turret, the gears were stuck. The hydraulics could not lift your turret back into the position for landing, right?
Nothing worked. So they told me they had to leave me in there where they landed.
So you are separated from the ground by a little thin sheet of plexiglass. That's the only thing that's going to protect you from getting skidded across the tarmac, right?
That's all that protected me, just that one little sheet.
So did you have some words of encouragement for the pilot? Did you promise him anything if he brought you home safe? Were you praying? What were you doing as those tense moments unfolded?
I can't really remember praying or doing anything else. All I know is I was scared. All I wanted to be back on the ground and out of this thing.
Tell me about that landing. I mean, did the plexiglass ever rub on the ground? Did he bring it in perfectly? What happened?
He brought that plane in like it was a baby. He landed that thing soft on the ground and nothing happened at all. I got out and actually I did kiss the ground too. But the day came out pretty good. After that, the king and his daughter came by and reviewed it. That was King George, of course, and Princess Elizabeth. She's, at that time, she was 17 years old. She had been taken out of her position as a mechanic. She was actually an auto mechanic, and they decided that royalty was not a place for royalty to be workers on a car or a vehicle. So they took her off of that and put her back into her royal duties.
And you had come across the Atlantic on the Queen Elizabeth I, and then the same day that you're afraid you're going to die because you're stuck in this turret, you end up meeting Queen Elizabeth II before she's ever crowned.
Met the future queen. Yep.
And did you ever go on a bombing mission or a reconnaissance mission in the air again?
No, that's the only time I ever went up in the plane.
And after that one, you probably weren't dying to go up in another one, huh?
No, I told them that I want to go someplace where it's safe. I'll go back in my tanks.
Yeah, that sounds like a real safe place. And having seen your Purple Heart, I know it turned out to be quite the dangerous place. We'll explore that when Hometown Heroes continues. 87-year-old Jim Gerhardt of Sacramento, California, our guest. We'll hear more of his story after a word from our sponsors, starting with Fresno Distributing.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out.
They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Here's an idea. If you heard Jim Gerhart describing how he survived in that crippled ball turret underneath the B-17, and you want to get an up-close view of what that might have been like, head out to Castle Air Museum in Atwater tomorrow for the annual Strawberry Waffle Brunch. You can walk right up to the B-17 and see for yourself. I've had the privilege of listening to a lot of B-17 stories over the years, and a few of them came from Ralph Johnson, a bombardier with the 94th Bomb Group, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 92. In fact, his memorial services are today. Anybody that knew Ralph knows what a special man he was. I feel honored to have been able to share his story with you while he was still around to tell it. And he's one of the many veterans I'll be thinking of on Memorial Day in a few weeks. I want to give you a heads up. KMJ is going to be airing a special two-hour edition of Hometown Heroes on Memorial Day, Monday, May 28th. Stay tuned for details on that. And let's get back now to the story of Jim Gerhart, who was pulled into that reconnaissance mission in the air, would later see plenty of action on the ground in tanks. But in early June of 1944, you had another duty. You said you were a spare part, and they had a use for you. What was that?
Well, again, my CO was contacted to send somebody to Cardiff, Wales, with another battalion. And so he notified me that I was being reassigned to this other battalion until further notice. So I joined them, and it rained all the way to Cardiff. And we've all had all the tanks with us, of course. We got to Cardiff, and the sun had come out by that time. It was a fairly good day. And so I'm standing in line waiting to get a tattoo at a tattoo parlor there, which was everybody else was doing. And they called me out of formation, and they told me I was the loader aboard the LST. And I told the sergeant I had no idea what he's talking about. He says, "You are now." He says, "You're the loader for that tank. You load the tanks on that ship over there." I says, "You're going to have to show me what I'm doing then." So he took me over and told me, "There's your tanks. There's the hoist. You get aboard. You motion to the guy on the crane to pick up the tank. You take the tank down below. You park it. You got a driver. Motion him to put in 21 tanks, and you're set to go." So I became a loader.
Why do I get the impression that you seem to be the guy who was always standing around with nothing to do and they had to find you something to do?
Well, that's just about what it is. As a spare parts, that's exactly what you do. You wait for something to happen that you go and take somebody else's place from whatever it is. I've done everything from guard duty. I even went to Scotland one time and taught for a week or two up in Scotland to teach English troops how to handle the tanks. Spent one time guarding trucks that had no identification on them at all. There was a dozen trucks, and it was four of us guarding trucks. That's all we did. We had no reason to truck call them, no reason to even guard them. We didn't know anything about them. We had one truck of rations, and that was us.
And in this occasion, just before American troops headed across the channel and landed at Normandy on June 6th, you had to load all those tanks, something you'd never done before on this LST. Did that all proceed smoothly, or did you hit a snag?
Only snag I hit is when I was on top of one of the turrets and I hit one of their speakers that hang down from the overhead. I didn't know the speakers were up there. Of course, I'm not paying attention to what's over my head. I'm paying attention to where my tank's at. And I ran into the speaker and tore the speaker off the overhead. That's the only thing that happened otherwise.
Well, that's not too bad. They were in for a lot worse than that when they got where they were going. And when did you get where you were going? How long was it before you headed across to France?
Well, the next day, we started across the channel with the rest of the group. And this was on the second landing, actually. We got across the channel all right. It was a little rough, but we got across the channel. And supposedly we landed on the beach. We hit a sandbar, as it turned out. But, of course, at that time, we didn't know it. I opened up the clamshell front and dropped the ramp. Brought my first tank out, and he went off the ramp and sunk. And I'm shocked to see this happen. I turn around and try to flag the second one down. And from that moment on, I don't remember anything for 3 weeks. I don't know if the rest of the tanks went out, whether they stayed aboard, the tank got blew up or what. I have no idea what happened. I wound up 3 weeks later and back with my unit again on shore.
So you really don't know what happened, and you haven't been able to piece it together by going to reunions or talking to anybody else, but it sounds like maybe something happened and you were knocked unconscious or something?
I don't know if I was knocked unconscious or what it was. I have no idea. And I don't really want to know anything about it either. Not really.
Was this at Omaha Beach or Utah Beach? Which beach did you guys land?
Omaha Beach.
On June 7th?
June 6th, actually.
So it was later in the day on June 6th?
Yes, on June 6th, yeah.
So the first tank went straight down. You tried to stop the second tank and nothing else. Don't remember anything after that point?
Don't remember anything else. I don't know what happened.
And it sounds like your take on that is that maybe you're fortunate you don't remember anything else and you're not dying to find out?
I don't want to find out anything about it. Not from what they tell me about what happened there or what the scene looked like or anything else. I don't want to see any of that.
Sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but sounds like you feel fortunate that you're alive and that it's pretty clear to you that things could have been a lot worse for you that day.
Well, it could have been a lot worse because we had guys shooting off the top of the cliff. They couldn't get any big guns pointed at us, but they had all kinds of small arms firing down at us. And I wasn't really, they couldn't hit me precisely anyway because I was inside the ship, but they could pick off anybody else off the deck or anything like this on the ship itself. Like I say, I don't know what happened.
And you mentioned, and I don't want to dwell on it too long, you mentioned that you obviously have heard what happened that day, and your home is a collection of military memorabilia, VHS tapes and books. I'm sure you've read so many accounts of Omaha Beach on June 6th. When you think about that day in history, knowing that you were there, you were a part of it, what do you think is significant to remember about that day? Why is that an important day in world history?
Well, I guess it's because it's one of the largest invasions ever took place in history. Movies and things like this give most people a false idea of what you see, what goes on, really. A person that is on the beach in an invasion sees a very limited amount of space, usually just what's in front of him and where the next cover is. He's not looking around to see who's getting killed, how many's getting killed, or anything else. All he's interested in is getting across the beach and into cover. That's all he's interested in. He's not interested in how many people are getting killed up and down the beach or anything else. All he's doing is worrying about himself, and if he happens to be a platoon leader, a company leader, or whatever, he is more likely to see more than the average soldier. The average soldier won't see anything except what's in front of him.
And you had already been exposed to a lot of things the average soldier did not see during the war. Well, let's move ahead to where you do remember. So you had 3 weeks that are blank in your memory there. From what you do remember, pick it up from there. There's a war going on, and you're in it. So what were you doing?
Well, when I come back to my senses, so to speak, I was with the unit again, and it was about a day later, we got bombed by, as I mentioned before, I seen the first P-38 when the war started, and a squadron of P-38s came over and bombed us. Because at that time, they didn't have recognition signals between the ground and air. And so the air people thought that the tanks they seen were German tanks because they were so far advanced that they weren't supposed to be that far advanced yet. So they bombed them.
So you're looking up at the sky at planes you know are yours, and they're dropping bombs on you. How close were you to being hit?
Oh, I was two or three tanks away. They dropped a bomb in a couple of tanks. Two tanks they hit, and that was all. They didn't really kill anybody, and I don't remember anybody get wounded, but it was kind of a scary situation.
And that wouldn't be the only one. Friendly fire wasn't the only fire headed your way. Where did your tanks head, and what was it like? I mean, how fierce was the combat?
Well, first I got to explain to you what our battalion was. Excuse the type of language I have to use on this, but in the military it was called a bastard battalion. We were. Other battalions had the same name. What we were independent tank battalions that were attached to different divisions and armies and countries, actually. And our job was to spearhead, primarily, any battle that they needed a spearhead for. And so they would pull a company of tanks out and send them to anywhere from the British Army, the French Army, our own, to different divisions to spearhead for their advance. That was our job.
So that first time that you were called on to spearhead something, I'm sure that has to be pretty memorable and had to be a little imposing knowing what you were doing.
Well, I think I wasn't called into a spearhead for quite a spell. I did a lot of other things in between. I was a border patrol. They gave me a constable out of Amsterdam as my interpreter, and my job was to patrol the coast for infiltrators coming in from the channel. And at that time, Guernsey Island and Jersey Island in the channel were still occupied by German troops. And our job was to make sure that none of them came ashore and infiltrated our lines and reported back to their lines what was happening, which was quite an interesting job.
Sounds a little bit like a needle in a haystack. I mean, how do you know?
You guess, really. We found a couple of them, but do you hear these questions? Well, I don't understand why they did this, because I guess everybody thought sports was the most important thing in America. But some of the questions were like, who was the world champions last year in baseball? Who's the most important player? These were the questions you ask whoever you stopped. And they were supposed to know the answers. If they didn't know the answers, you sent them to intelligence at headquarters and let them question them.
So you were kind of the first level of defense. You were the screener.
We were the screeners, yeah. It was an interesting job, though.
Well, and I think interesting can be used to describe a lot of the things that you went through during World War II. Well, I don't want to skip ahead if there's something more important you want to mention in between, but what's this story about you were trying to escape on the Autobahn and got in a pretty sticky situation, stuck between a rock and a hard place, or a German who wanted to shoot you?
Well, I had dropped off my interpreter in Amsterdam, and I was traveling back to the unit, and I was on this Autobahn. Autobahn is a German highway, and a Messerschmitt decided that they just decided to use me for target practice. So they chased me about a mile and a half down the Autobahn with their machine guns, and I finally skidded off the highway, and then at that time, they used to stack bombs along the highway in stacks for storage, usually. And they were, 8-10 feet apart, these stacks. And my Jeep skidded in between two stacks, and all I had was about 6 inches on each end. So there was no way in the world I could get out of it. And the Messerschmitt just took off, and he flew away. But I had to find a way to get back to my unit to get a truck out there to haul me out again.
How'd you pull that off?
I went and told him that I got chased into a hole. Come and get me out of here.
You were able to get him on the radio or something, or you had to walk to the nearest troops or what?
Oh, no, I had to walk. I didn't have no radio. Our radios consisted of walkie-talkies, and you had to have a wire to talk on them.
So you're hoping the plane doesn't shoot you. Then you end up in a spot where even if he misses you, he's going to blow you to smithereens by hitting the hot ammunition to your left or to your right. Was that the least bit scary to you, or just more adventures for young Mr. Gerhardt?
For me, I didn't even think about them hitting the ammunition. All I was thinking about was getting myself out of the hole again.
Mm-hmm. And clearly you did. You're here talking to me, but you would have even closer calls than that. You said it was a while till you were involved in one of these spearhead situations. But when you were, what was that like? Can you give us a glimpse? You talked about the tunnel vision that a soldier can have, that you see what's in front of you. You don't always see that big picture. But to be part of that spearhead, part of these tanks that are going in there trying to break through, what was that experience like for you?
Like I said, I was a spare part. And so this one night about 8 o'clock in the evening or something like this, I came in the mess hall looking for somebody to go out with another unit as a spearhead. And this is a unit of light tanks. Now, a light tank has got 5/8 of inch in armor is all they got on top and bottom. That's all the armor. And I had never been in one, so I didn't know anything about it, except it was primarily, essentially the same as any other tank. And so they told me they needed a loader and radio man aboard it. So I told them I'd go with them. And so I was transferred to this Company D. The sergeant in charge was a man named McCafferty. And so he taught me how to load the gun, which was a new 75 cannon. And it was a simple gun to operate. All you had to do is slam the shell in and fire the gun. The shell was ejected. You threw it out and put another one in. You could fire them, probably 3 rounds a minute, easy, out of them. So he taught me this while we're traveling down through the highway at night. And I'm using live ammunition, of course, on this practice. And we went through Aachen in just at daylight. We hit Aachen, Germany. And we crossed the river over to a place called Jülich, where we assembled for the start of the advance. A plane came over, German Stuka. He came over and dropped two bombs and a flock of anti-personnel bombs who blew up a minefield in front of us. He didn't hit anybody with the bombs either. And so we passed up the hill, went over the hill, come down the other side. We hit a couple of anti-personnel mines, which just shake you up a little is all. It's a little startling, but it doesn't hurt anything. Tank commander stopped the tank to assist somebody else, and about that time we took a round, a German round, 88, through the engine compartment. As I found out later from a retriever, the round came through the engine compartment, right down the dead center of the two engines, the two Cadillac engines. Took off all the spark plugs, went through the firewall into the turret, and then exploded inside the turret where we were sitting. You don't remember anything about an explosion. You get a big red flash, your ears start ringing. You don't really feel any pain. You don't really know what happened either. And I know when I came to, I knew that I'd been hit, of course, but the explosion ripped open my jacket, zipper. I didn't get blinded right then, but my eyes burned, of course. My ears were still ringing. In one hand, I had a glove on for handling hot shells, and one gland was bare. And when the shell went off, it was only 2 feet away or so. So my left side got pretty well tore apart. And the tank commander, he was on the other side of the turret. His right side got all tore up because he was on the opposite side. The gunner who was in front of it was only about a foot from the explosion. He was killed. The driver right in front of him was also killed. The turret raised in the air and came back down and trapped the assistant driver inside the tank. So he was stuck there, and there was no way to get him out. And so he burned to death in the tank. I finally got out through the turret, because I had left my turret open, because I considered that 5/8 inch of armor on the tank is not going to stop anything coming through anyway. And so I went out to the top, and I discovered two men, engineers, on the back of our tank. And so I pulled them off the tank and took them with me out into a 105 hole out in the middle of the field to wait for medics. And while we're out there, they kept throwing mortar shells and a few rounds of 88s out in the field. And a couple of them, two mortar shells landed alongside of us, and both of them duds. But then one of the bombs went off, and it blew another hole not too far from us. And some of the fragments came down and burned us from that. That was about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning. And we were out there till almost 5 that afternoon before the medics. Well, I can't say the medics, because it wasn't the medics that came after us. Our own people came after us. We didn't have any medics come out after us. And they took us back to the aid station. Of course, by this time, I know I got a leg busted up and bad, and I had a tournament on it. And I doctored up the other two guys with sulfur drugs to keep them from getting infected or poisoned. And they evacuated them too, and they took me back to an aid station. And they gave me a nice shot of morphine, which made me feel pretty good. Then they put me on a jeep. When they was picking me up, they put me on a board. They didn't have a stretcher. They put me on a board. And when they did, they twisted my leg, which was quite painful. And if there was any new cuss words invented, I invented them that day. And they probably could have heard me as far as Berlin, because I was really upset. And they got me back to the aid station. They fixed me up there a little bit. They put me on a jeep. They also put blankets around me because I was freezing. And it was cold. It was in February morning. It was February 25th, yeah. And it was still freezing weather. And so when I got on this Jeep, they put one blanket over me, and it took about a mile before that blanket was gone. So by the time I got to the hospital in Liège, Belgium, I was almost frozen again. And then they put me on a stretcher to take me up to the room where they put you in to put you in line to be the next operated on. They had a buzz bomb come over, which was a German, kind of a jet air, gasoline jet engine thing. And it exploded. It landed and exploded in the courtyard of the hospital. And the German prisoners, they dropped me. And so I skidded all the way down the stairs, bounced from step to step down a whole flight of stairs. And they finally got me upstairs and they put me in the hallway. By this time, of course, I'm blind. I can't see anything, can't hear much either. So I heard somebody ask me if I wanted a cigarette, and of course I said sure. I didn't know if I could smoke or not, since most of my face, my left side of my face was burned, and my hands were burned, a few other things. And they had already cut my helmet off because it was burned to my head, so they had to cut it off already. Then somebody asked me a cigarette, and later I found out it was the movie star Van Johnson that had offered me the cigarette. Then I remember going into the operating room, and they had us all in cots there, and they took my temperature. And when they took my temperature, the thermometer was so cold that I actually broke it. My cheeks were chattering. And they asked me, told me it was my time for me to go. And I said, well, take this guy next to me. He's held up worse off than I am. And so they took him, and everything went all right. They fixed me up. They wrapped me up primarily from head to toe with bandages. So when I was in them, took me to the ward, and of course the only problem I had there was, the only thing I had open was my mouth, had a bandage across my whole face, of course. And I had enough room for a spoon to get through, and I had a French nurse that every time she asked me something, which I didn't know what she was saying, she'd stick something in my mouth to eat. And if I tried to tell her no, I'd get something else stuck in my mouth. And that was the only bad part about it. And then about a week later, I had somebody, a doctor I assumed, asked me about my eyes. I said, well, I feel all right. I didn't use particularly nice language about this doctor down there who's going to see about my eyes, this colonel. He says, well, we'll see about what we can do. So the next day, they took me down, unbandaged my eyes, and I could see enough to see light and figures. And it turned out the guy I cussed out was the colonel to start with. So anyway, I got away with it. But we had one guy in there that had been down in the courtyard when that buzz bomb hit, and he'd been thrown up against the wall, and he was bruised from head to toe. He didn't have anything broken, he was just bruised, but he was completely out of his mind, and he'd cuss, and then he'd pray, and he'd cuss, and then he'd pray. And they fed him enough drugs for the whole ward, and never fazed him. He still had done the same thing, so they finally moved him out of our ward, out into the balcony where it was cold, let him freeze. So I seen him later when we got on the plane to go to England for transfer, and they put him clear on the other side of the building where it was freezing too. So I don't know what happened to him. But then we got on the plane. They just happened to put me next to the door, and I was in the top bunk. I didn't have my blankets. They had taken my blankets away from me. I didn't have blankets over my feet. My one foot, my right foot, was almost blue from cold by the time I got to England. And I got off of the plane in England. They put us in an ambulance. Now, an English ambulance is about, three bunks high, and you ride in it, it's like you're in a ship going through a storm because it rocks back and forth, and you're sure it's going to fall over. Anyhow, we finally get to the hospital. We go in the hospital, and then the only thing I really appreciated there was white sheets, and they gave me a quart of milk. And it was first white sheets and quart of milk I've had in almost a year.
I'm struck, and I know that you lived this, and I'm sure there have been many nights you thought about it. You've told the story a few times. But to hear you describe it so matter-of-factly, I can't help but think of how horrifying all of this is. I mean, you're hit to begin with this 88 shell right through your tank. You're incapacitated just about. You find your way out of the tank. You're hit again by mortar fire. You're more concerned about these other guys with you. You're helping take care of them. You end up blind for a few weeks. It's going to take you more than 9 months to recover and get back to health. In those kind of moments, for instance, from 9 in the morning till 5 o'clock, waiting in a hole in the ground that one of the American artillery had made, hoping that someone's going to come rescue you, What do you do for that time? What's going through your mind, and how did you believe that you were actually going to make it through all of this?
Well, I knew I was going to make it. I had no doubts about that. I knew I was bad enough that I might wind up with a leg being off, but that really didn't concern me too much. I was still alive. I was still one piece.
The enemy was still firing your way.
First, they got to hit me. So far, they haven't hit me.
So it didn't bother you. And it didn't bother you when the buzz bomb hit the hospital and the German prisoners dropped you down a flight of stairs when you're already in all kinds of pain?
A little more pain didn't matter anymore at that time. One thing about me that wasn't quite the same with anybody else, I'm a loner by nature. And I didn't have any friends to say, we were friends in the Army. I knew a lot of them, yes. And I know a lot of them now, 100 times more now than I did then. Now I was spoke about this other guy telling him because he was wounded more than I was. He happened to be my sergeant that was in the tank with me. And I didn't even know it. He knew it, but he didn't tell me. I didn't tell him all about it until I went to a military reunion that we had back in, I forgot now, Kentucky or somewhere. And he came to our first military reunion that he came to, and he told me that I was had sent him to the doctor ahead of me. And that's the first I even knew about it. And then I had another person come up and thanking me for saving her husband's life, and I didn't have any idea who she's talking about. And it turns out that the one he was wanting to take was a real good friend of my tank commander, a guy named Van Voorhees, Russ Van Voorhees from Florida. And he couldn't because he was the only radio operator repairman we had, so he couldn't go. So his wife was so happy that I went and got busted up instead of him. So she says, I saved his life. And I didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, he would have been where you were. And it sounds like, too, as you gave us so in such great detail, that moment when the German shell came into your tank and where everybody was and what happened to him. And the picture I got was that if that shell is an inch or two off, or if you were positioned in a different spot in that tank, you wouldn't be here talking to me right now.
I guess. I was sitting there, well, cross-legged like on the floor of the tank, which is your normal position. You're in reach of the ammunition. You pull out a shell to put it in a gun. The only time you stood up is if you had to get up to get out of the tank, is the only time you had to get up.
Well, I really cannot imagine living through that, and I'm guessing most of our listeners can't either. Remember to check out KMJNow.com for some photos of our guest today, Jim Gerhart. You can find him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, too. And we'll be back with the rest of his story after more from our sponsors, like Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, JennAir, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559
1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Jim Gerhart has given us really descriptive detail today, and there's more that I couldn't fit into the time constraints of this program. So if you want to hear the full conversation unedited, listen to the podcast version at kmjnow.com. Jim told us about that German 88 shell that hit the light tank he was in, wounding him badly and killing some of his fellow crewmen. He would be blind for weeks after that attack in February of 1945, and it would take until around Thanksgiving that year to recover. What was the most difficult thing you faced during those 9 months of recovery?
Getting along with people after I got out of service. I got along fine with people in the service because they were all... One thing that happens to you is you get old. You really do. You get old. Your outlook completely changes. And now I'm not even 21 yet. I'm 21 in October. And I'm still 20 years old. By the time I'm getting out, I was 21 years, 1 month, and 16 days old when I was discharged from the service and the medical, which very much upset me because I wanted to stay in for 30 years. But anyway, when I got home, it was like being in a college graduate or a person that was a whole lot older meeting these children because they had all these dumb things that they did, going out to parties and things like this. They didn't worry about anything. They didn't care about anything else but their own well-being or anything like this. I had a hard time getting used to this.
With everything that you had seen, everything that you experienced, all the friends that you saw killed, it sounds like it was really hard for you to identify with that.
One thing you just said right there that didn't really apply to me, when you said I seen friends killed.
Fellow soldiers killed, whether they were friends or not, huh?
Fellow soldiers, yes, but not friends, not people I knew. Now, the tank I was in, I had been in this tank from approximately 9 o'clock one night until 9 o'clock the next morning. This is how long I knew these five people. My tank commander, the gunner, the driver, the assistant driver, I don't even remember their names. The only one I remember, of course, is the tank commander. The officer from the company commander, he had never met me, never had talked to him, so I didn't know anybody there. And as far as friends are concerned, I didn't really have time to make friends. I was always doing something else that didn't have anything to do with them. I knew them by sight, you know, and I knew them by name, but as far as friends was concerned, I didn't really have any friends. And as far as I'm concerned, there should be no such thing as friends in the service. Friends is what gets you stirred up, gets you in trouble. They get killed, and you're in a hell of a position. You can't think right when they get killed. You worry about them. It makes the whole thing, everything very difficult for you.
Now, whenever I interview a veteran who served in the European theater, I like to ask him about May 8th. 1945, VE Day, the day that part of the war came to an end. Of course, your war ended on February 25th of 45, really. But I think May 8th has some special significance to you, too. Why is that?
That's my day I came back to the United States. I got off of General Huddleston, the hospital ship, in Charleston, South Carolina, on May the 8th at 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was nobody on the dock but the medical personnel and a few Red Cross workers. The buses or whatever it was going to take us to the hospital. They had no celebration or anything else, and we had just been told as we were getting off the ship that the war was over. And that's how where I was on May the 8th. It was right there on the ship getting off.
You already told me that it was so difficult for you to kind of immerse yourself back into society with where people your age didn't have the life experience, the understanding that you had because of your time in the war. What about physically? Were there lingering effects of the injuries that you suffered that stayed with you for a while, maybe even to this day?
Unfortunately, yes. For the first 5 years, I had, buku problems, primarily my knee. A piece of fragment about the size of my fist had penetrated my knee and took out the patella kneecap and tore the joint apart. And, of course, when they put it back together, they didn't put no kneecap in or anything like this. And, of course, the leg down below was broken, too. And two or three toes were broken, part of the foot, and had a few multiple wounds in my body from clear up to my face. My jaws were broken in a couple of places. But afterwards, my knee would swell, and it would get quite large, and I'd start hallucinating. And I'd get a high fever up to 105, 106 degrees. And I'd hallucinate and see all kinds of strange things going on that weren't happening. So I'd wind up in a hospital again. So this went on for almost 5 years until we finally figured out what was wrong with the knee. It was going sideways, going too far back, actually. And this was what was causing it to balloon out and for me to get this fever, which one fever took place in a hospital. It's not a pleasant thing when you come out of it or when you remember it, because it's all crazy things that happen to you.
For some reason, the word that keeps coming to my mind is survivor. Do you feel like you've had to survive a little more than the average American?
I don't know if I feel like it that, but I sure as hell survived everything. I'm considered a survivor, and besides, I got a guardian angel that takes care of me.
What's her name?
I don't really know, but I wish I did know her name.
Well, that was my next question, and some may say it's cliche or melodramatic, but for someone who's been through what you've been through and have had to spend so much energy over the years contemplating it and dealing with the effects of it, I think myself and all our listeners want to know why. Why do you think you have been able to do what you've done? Why did you survive with all these close calls, with everything you've been through? Why do you think that has been your fate and your destiny? How do you make sense of all of that?
I don't really know how to make any sense of it all, except that I'm a great believer in if your number's up, your number's up. And it might be that the Lord doesn't want me yet, and the devil don't want anything to do with me. I've told a couple of preachers and clergymen, when they questioned me about death, I said, well, I'm not going to go either place. I'm going to be at the crossroads directing traffic, because I know what everybody is. That's the answer, only can I, way I can feel it.
I'm guessing there's some gratitude somewhere in your heart, or do you feel, has there ever been frustration or bitterness or anger that you've had to deal with the effects of this injury for so long?
The only thing I regret is that they didn't cut my leg off. I had, to this day, I had wished they had amputated my left leg from the knee down. Everybody that has been with a brace, you're limited to everything you can do. You can't do a lot of things. If you have an artificial limb, there's a lot of things that you can do. A lot of people help you. You can do a lot of things that you can do with that, which you can't do with a brace. And I've met other people that have the same problem. They have a brace, and they're limited to what they can do, and they see somebody there that doesn't have a brace, and they're out skiing, you know? So this is one of the things that I kind of regret. Not I've been trying. In fact, I even tried to get the doctor to cut it off this time. My knees were bothering me. I told him either fix them, replace them, or cut the damn things off, you know?
What did it mean to you to receive the Purple Heart?
Well, I thought it was an honor, all right. Purple Heart was given to me when I was in the hospital in Liège. And along with several hundred other people, they didn't have any ceremonies. They come around and he says, they read off this list, and, oh, yeah, you get this one, and he hands it to you, and they go to the next bed.
Was it all worth it for you?
Well, to me it was worth it because, like I say, I'm a loner, and I spend most of my time, all my free time I spent, any time I had a pass or a free weekend or whatever, I traveled. Of course, I was one of the fortunate ones that could go out there and do what I wanted. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't party or anything like this, so most of my time was spent traveling around. I had an enjoyable time, really.
I know we're getting short on time here, but your collection of military memorabilia is quite extensive. Why do you do that? Why do you gather so many relics from World War One, World War Two, you name it?
I don't know. They just interest me that mostly in how much it advances in technology, I think, is mostly what it is. My kids will look at this stuff, and I've got things from World War One, backpacks and things like this.
You mentioned your kids, and it occurs to me, if you hadn't survived all these close calls, you never would have met your wife. You never would have had any kids. When you think about that, what comes to mind? Is that humbling to think of that, or what does that do to you when you consider that possibility?
Well, it kind of surprises me, since I've got seven boys, and of course, All of them have got kids except for two of them. They're still bachelors. I realize, of course, that this would not have happened if I hadn't been. I've been married twice. And my first wife and I had three children. And this wife and I had two, and I adopted two more from hers.
Well, I want to thank you for serving our country. And I'm curious if there's anything else you want to share with us that you're most thankful for after everything you've been through.
Well, I'm thankful that the Lord decided he didn't want me, that's for sure. I have a good home. I have a good wife. She puts up with me, which is a very difficult thing for her to do. I'm better now than I used to be. I used to have quite a bad temper. Now I'm fairly mellow now. I enjoy life. I enjoy collecting, unfortunately. And as you have seen, my collections are quite extensive. And it goes everything from model trains to military and everything in between, I think.
Well, one of the few collections I have is a growing stash of interviews with men and women that I am honored to call friends, and I am very delighted to add your story to that bunch. Jim Gerhart, 87 years old of Sacramento, California, has been our guest today. See and hear more at KMJNow.com, and join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.